Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Tonalities podcast. I am your host, James Ennard, joined by my good friend, Timmy Lang.
Hi, everyone.
Roman is on the deck. Say hi, Roman.
Hi, Roman.
And we're just waiting for two patrons to come down and observe a podcast and sit on the couch in our lovely new studio. This is our second week in the studio, and it's going to be our third podcast down here. I've been very happy with the last two.
Me too.
Going forward, we're going to lead into the upcoming interview with this short 5 or 10 minute piece from me and Timmy. So this is it. Timmy, how are you?
I'm very, very well, James, mentally, but I feel a little bit under the weather at the moment.
You look a bit run down.
Yeah, I'm a bit of pain. My body is, my bones are all rattling inside my skin.
So. Is it cold?
No, it's not too bad, but my whole body is vibrating, let's say that.
Is it just run down from work?
I think so. The kids were a little bit ran down last week and there was no COVID, thankfully. And Tommy, my brother, got one as well and he'd no COVID. So.
And I had the flu myself. I was out of work for 3 days, but it wasn't COVID, thankfully.
It's the change of the weather. It always happens, the change of weather. And it happens in March and April as well when we go from the cold into the hotter weather.
Also as well, over the last 2 years, we've been so careful with hand sanitization and masks that our immune systems are probably weakened. Mm. And now things are being relaxed again and we're getting hit with all this stuff that we would have fought off easily. Because we've been so careful, our bodies, like, we don't need to be so strong anymore because he's washing his hands more often. But anyway, we did a podcast last night with Jerry Murray and that's what the lads are going to be listening to after this. What did you make of it?
Jerry was, you know, I found him to be a very, very nice man, very relaxed, mellow. You know, you could see real sense of calmness around him. His story was, in my eyes, was very, very inspirational.
Yeah, without giving too much away.
That's what I was conscious of.
There was a lot to it. There was a lot to it and it was very interesting and it was pure chilled out conversation.
Yeah. I will say this one thing, right? You don't have to be a city bird to become destroyed from...
Yeah.
Criminality and addiction.
Or a country folk get it too.
Yeah.
And so I hope everybody enjoys that. This is the first podcast where we're having two patrons down to observe, and we'll be doing this regularly. Not for every guest, because it wouldn't be appropriate to have a live audience in front of somebody that may be uncomfortable with. But Stan Knott is our guest tonight. And so we're having two patrons down, Deirdre O'Mahony and her sister, whom I can't remember right now.
Inda
cancelled.
Oh, did she?
So okay. It's Deirdre and her sister, and we're just waiting on them down now. So it's great to invite patrons down.
It is, and to get them to share this whole experience with them, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who pay it.
Exactly.
So, exactly. And just a shout out to the patrons again. Thank you so much for this. You know, everybody can see what we're after doing to the studio below here. And it's absolutely amazing, and I hope everybody gets an opportunity to come in here, every one of you.
Exactly, and no, it's great, and we've got big announcements coming as well this week, which we will hold back on for now. So, without further ado, we will introduce Jerry Murray, and we see everybody next week.
God bless.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Tonalities podcast. I'm your host, James Ennor, joined by my good friend, Timmy Lang.
Hi, everyone.
Say hi, Rowan.
Hi, Rowan.
Rowan's on the decks, as always. And this week, we have Jerry Murray down from County Louth. Jerry Murray, you put on events where you help people to fulfill their potential and overcome obstacles and all other sorts of stuff. And you're a life coach and you're an author and you've got an interesting story. But for the people that don't know you, first of all, thanks for coming down to meet us.
Thanks for having me.
It's not exactly around the corner. And you know you're going home afterwards, and it's night time now, so much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks,
We know a little bit about you, but you want to just bring it right back for the people that don't know anything about you. Just tell us a little bit about where you're from, what it was like growing up.
Okay, so I live in a little village called Talenstown in County Louth. I'm living there 12 years. I used to live in a County Monaghan town called Castleblaney. When I was growing up, when I was a baby, I was fostered into my cousin's family. And I had a different last name than my foster parents. So that left with a lot of bullying at school. And it left with me when I was growing up. I didn't really feel belonged and stuff like that, you know, and I got a lot of bullying at school, you know. If anyone wanted to know me, they'd say, there's Jerry Murray there. He's no more than father, you know. I was fighting talk from back then, you know, really, really annoyed me, you know. But so I didn't get off to a great start in that end, you know, but I can remember coming home one time off the school bus, and there was this guy in a car sitting in the driver. Now, I was only 11 years old, like, at the time. And I basically, cut long story short, I write about in my book why he was arrested and that, but I was arrested in the wrong and was took away. The guards took me away. I was only 11, and they made me admit something I didn't do, you know, breaking into someone's house and that. I honestly didn't do it, like, but I can see why they did think I'd done it, you know. So when they made me admit that, then everybody in my local area and that, if something happened or something like that there, it was me that got the blame for it then, you know. So I was getting the blame for all this stuff as I grew up and that, and it wasn't me that was doing it at all, you know. Really, really annoyed me. But so then I kind of, as I got older then, around 22, 23, I wanted to get me revenge with the guards and that. So I used to kind of just really taunt them all the time, and I would have been known to be a really good driver in a car, you know, and I used to be chasing them and winding them up, and they never could catch me, like, you know. But now I'd done a lot of stuff to wind them up, you know. But I felt like, you know, it was my way to get them back for what they'd done, you know.
Do you know when you were a child in school, so you were adopted by this foster couple. Did you get on well with them?
Oh, I did. Yeah, they were great. They were actually my cousins.
You was kept in the family, but I suppose you might still have, like, did you still have a feeling of, like, abandonment, or, like, did that have an impact on your mental health growing up? Like, did you experiment, or?
Of course it did, you know. Like, you know, I was seeing psychiatrists from a young age. Like, you know, I was depressed from a very young age. Like, I remember when I'd be going to school on the bus, I used to be looking out the window, and I'd be looking at a lake, like, and I'd be thinking that if only had the balls to do it, like, you know, I never really wanted to live, like, you know. So I was putting a lot of strong medications from a very, very young age, like, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
What was school like for you? The bullying, but were, like, academically, were you okay in school? Or?
No. Like, in school, like, I would have been the worst student in the school, like, you know. The school teachers used to tell me I'd never be any good at anything, like.
What about sports?
No.
Just a good driver.
Just a good driver. I was brought up on a farm too, so you know,
What kind of a farm?
Oh, we had cows, and you know, it was a big farm. We had two separate farms, you know, but
tough work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was tough work back then. It was you know, bales of hay and all that kind of stuff, you know.
But, you know, in the city in this day and age, and you might be able to speak a little bit more to this thing because you've got kids at the moment, but in this day and age, especially in the cities, you know, with the PlayStations and phones and laptops and social media, I'd say it's a far cry from the childhood you experienced on a farm in Monaghan and Louth.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, things are changing a lot now, like, you know.
You know, when you left school then, did you do an apprenticeship, or was it just to stay on the farm? Like, is that how it works?
No, would you believe my first job was when I was 15, and it was making coffins. that was my first job, making coffins.
That's the first thing we've heard here.
Yeah, making coffins. I was a carpenter making coffins. That was my first job,
What was that like? How did you get into it? Was this just
it was just through a friend of mine got me the job. He was at it, and yeah, I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed working with the wood and all that kind of stuff. You know,
do you know, like when you look at caskets and coffins, like the serious craftsmanship goes into them. I'd say
there is, the same work you put into a fit of kitchen and more actually.
Go out there because they are expensive, and some go for up to €10,000 even beyond that. Did you stay at it for long?
Yeah, about 2 years.
Go away, and what happened after that?
I went then, went working on pianos then, would you believe it, restoring pianos. Different stuff.
Interesting though.
Talented. You know, pianos are very technical, aren't they?
So good with the hands.
I enjoyed that, like,
After, how long were you doing the pianos for?
I was doing that for probably around 3.5 years, 4 years.
Do you know, so you're in your early 20s there. Were you getting involved in trouble around?
I wasn't too bad around that age, but when I was 21, I decided I wanted to meet my biological dad. And so I had started my own business at this time. Now, I started my own business restoring furniture myself, like on my own. I enjoyed it, you know, a lot of time to think. So I was thinking, you know, about my dad and all that. And I said, you know, I'm going to go and meet him. So I went down to his place of work, and he wasn't there. And I left my phone number that, and he called me that night. And I was very excited about, you know, because I was thinking, oh, does he look like me and all this? What's he, is the same personality? So I was very excited about meeting him, you know, and I really had my hopes up about it. So he called me that night, and I answered the phone. He says, "Who's this?" And I says, "Gerard Murray." He says, "I don't know you." I says, "Gerard Murray, your son." And I told him this story that I was going away to America just to make it easier for him to meet me. Like, you know, I told him I was going away, you know, just to let him know that I didn't want anything. I just wanted to meet him before I went. And then he just says to me, "Jerry," he says, "you live your life and I'll live my life." And basically hung up the phone, you know. And really, I really took that bad. And I remember, I'll never forget it. I got off the phone and I blamed it on myself. I thought it was all my fault. Like, you know, I thought it was me. And, you know, I started to think then, you know, what that school teacher said to me, you know, that I'm good for that. You know, she's actually right. I am good for that.
You start internalizing all this negativity.
Yeah, I did. And then I started, you know, turning to, like, I wouldn't have been smoking hash and stuff like that at that time, but I started taking cocaine and that then, you know. And,
you know, before you get on to that side of it, do you know the parents that raised you? Do you call them your parents?
Oh, I do, yeah. Mum and dad.
Were they your mother's side?
They were, yeah.
And do you know your father? Did he grow up in the same town?
Oh, no.
Okay, so you would have never come across him?
No.
What about your biological mother?
Oh, yeah. I'm still in great contact with her now, yeah.
Great.
She was an alcoholic, like, and, you know, but she's given up the drink now. She actually inspired me to...
And that's great to hear.
Yeah,
I can really understand how something like that... Your father, who you had all these hopes and aspirations. I didn't meet my own father till I was 20, you know, and there was a lot of hope there. And growing up, I always wanted to be like him and all these different things, you know. But, like, you were probably suffering already with insecurities, you know, lacks of self-esteem and confidence because of your own growing up through bullying and whatever else. And then for somebody that you put a lot of hope and what care and that you wanted to be loved. You basically wanted to be all we ever want is to be loved, Jerry. You know, and I know that from my own experience. You know, all I wanted was to be loved. Something that I didn't really get too much of growing up, you know. And to be turned away by something like that, it must have really, really hit you right in the gut, like. And I'd say it was probably the turning point in your life then. Maybe going down the wrong road or the drugs and everything else.
When you think about it, like, you probably, as soon as you picked up, it was probably going to end up bad for you, like, because you had these underlying issues, no? Oh. And we've had a few people on to us actually recently, people that have been in similar circumstances to yourself. They wanted us to cover the topic because not people directly in the same situation as you, but children have been adopted or children have grown up in the care system, they're way overrepresented in treatment centres, prisons and homeless hostels, you know. So there's a serious correlation between adoption and care and negative life outcomes, you know, because even if you had no great foster parents and your mother was able to, you had a good relationship with her, there's still something there, do you know what I mean? And like Timmy said, you'll always want your father, do you know what I mean? And if it didn't work out for you, like, return to substances. And absolutely. Do you know when you started experimenting? Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so look, I started with the cocaine, I got addicted to it for a good few years. Then I started getting involved in different crimes and that.
Mm.
Then I got 2 years in prison.
Right, you skipped way on there. So you went straight into the cocaine. So there wasn't like, typically people like, oh, I started smoking hash and it's not solvents. But because you were working, man, you're doing your own business at this stage. Mm. So you had money, so you were able to get cocaine. And then you got involved in crime. Was that directly through the drugs? Did you like start to use the snort and coke and then start selling it in weight? Or did you commit other crimes to get the money for the coke? Or how did it work out?
As you know, cocaine's a dear habit. Like
it is,
you know,
yeah.
So when
yeah.
I started getting involved in crime to be able to buy the cocaine, like, you know, lost my business and, you know, I was full-time in the crime then at that stage, like.
As you do, you have to feed it, you have to do it somewhere,
yeah.
You know, and crime really is, especially if you're good at certain things like driving and stuff like that,
yeah.
You know, you're going to turn to what you're good at. If it's absolutely. Not through education or through you being a craftsman or something like that, you're going to turn to the next thing.
If you can't sing or you're not a movie actor.
Exactly. So you got a job with your driving skills?
I did, yeah.
Courier, yeah.
You
probably can't tell us the details in that now because you might be dragged in for a section after.
I had no money at all.
Yeah. But obviously that didn't work out too good for you. Eventually you ended up in prison.
Yeah, look, as I say, like, you know, when I was currying, you know, like the relationship I had with the guards and that wasn't good. Like, so they knew I was currying and I was currying for a man they really wanted as well, you know, and... So me and him became very good friends, and so it became like a war with me and him against the guards, like, and that. And so they never could catch me driving ever. Like,
do you know when you were carrying drugs in your car? Did you always have confidence that no matter what pulled up, you were going to get away?
Absolutely. I used to say this to the guards. I used to say, if you ever catch me driving, I'll shake your hand.
Go away with that.
Honest to God. And I was dead serious, like, because I knew they never would.
We'll have to go counting someday. You know, yeah. It's the only place we can get away with driving like that these days.
That's true, yeah.
So how did you get caught?
It wasn't through me driving. It was through, so it would have been back in when I was about 23. I was working in Dublin at the time. And I met this girl and we were going out for a while and she moved into my flat and she wasn't there one evening. I was tidying up the flat and I found a needle in the flat and she was taking heroin. I found out she was taking heroin. Like, I never would have known anything about heroin at the time. So I was down home and she messaged me looking for her stuff out of the flat. I said, I'll be back there on Monday, I'll give it to you then. And she's no one wanted now. I said, look, I'm down home for the weekend, I'll give it to you Monday. So then she messaged me saying, look, I've something to tell you, I've HIV, so have you. So I was there, when he's saying this to me, it pissed me off. Like. So I remember me and her had a conversation before with people that took their lives and that, and I was telling her about a friend of mine that how he took his life and that, and I told her I was going to do the same, like, you know, if I had it. Thinking she texted back, no, look, you don't have it, you know. But she texted back, you know, there's... No, but I wanted to hear she texts back saying there's medication out there now that'll help you. You know, so that really, I was like, oh shit.
What year is this now?
Probably would have been maybe around 2000, probably around 2000, maybe around that year, 2002 or 3, something around that. Like,
you know. And in County Louth, was this, you were in County Louth at this time?
No, I would have been around my home place in Castlelady.
Was heroin a big thing up there at the time?
No, well, see, she was from Dublin.
Oh, okay.
She was from Dublin.
The fucking Dubs are the bastards.
Jim, you're going to be putting a hit list over there.
I'm a half a Dub, so I can get away with it. But no, because I only say that because the heroin problem was kind of isolated to Dublin at that time. You know, because around that time in Cork, we didn't really have a heroin problem. I was thinking the other counties was probably similar enough. But it did spread, obviously. And did you end up testing positive for HIV?
No, but like there was no heroin down around where I was, like at all.
It's
like,
just that she was from Dublin.
It was just Dublin, yeah. But I went to get tested with my doctor, and the doctor, you know, I thought I'd get that test straight away. But then he told me I had to wait for a second test for 6 months.
That's right, yeah.
So I really just went crazy in that 6 months, and I got involved in it. Didn't give a crap, like, do you know what I mean? What? So I got involved. I stole some machinery,
what kind of machinery?
Tractors. Tractors.
You laugh, weird. There's serious money involved in machinery, and it's a big thing within Northern Ireland and the Republic.
How, like, you probably can't tell me, like, but I'm trying to think, like, how do you actually rob a tractor? It's not like going in and putting a fucking down your back pocket or, you know, into a tin foil bag. Like, are you going in with a lorry and loading it up the back of it and taking off out of it? Have you got buyers for equipment like that before you go in?
Look, I'd just send someone up to, like, look, it was a once off. This time it was our first time doing it, and me and a couple of friends done it. It was just, look, any key nearly starts them all, so.
Good to know.
Just in case things don't work out. Like,
be swinging out of a massive focus in there now when the podcast goes bust.
Yeah.
That won't happen. But no, that's interesting stuff. So we went mad for that 6 months. I can understand why. You think, fucking hell, you know, the world is going to end. And what happened after the end of the 6 months? Do you get the results?
Got the results, they were clear, yeah, it was all clear.
Good,
yeah.
You were lucky.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Well, do you know what? That must have been fucking tough. Ooh. Really, really tough to live 6 months, like, to know that you might have something that could affect you for the rest of your life. Because, as we all know, there's a lot of people that get blood transfusions, get HIV from it, and other forms of blood diseases through that way, like. It must be absolutely awful for people to be told, like, you've HIV, never before used needle or was out there selling themselves or anything like that. And to be told, like, it must be an awful thing to have over you for 6 months.
I think before you can give blood, you have to be tested anyway.
Is it?
So I don't think you can get it passed through blood transfusions.
Okay.
But like previously, my previous life, I had hepatitis A, which you get through dirty water and stuff, you know? So I remember when I came into recovery, got tested, you know, check out everything. That was the only thing. They just said they had antibodies that fought it. But you can get it through dirty fruit and water and all these mad things. It's more common in third world countries, but the lifestyle and you're an active addiction, it's just dirty, and I was using intravenously. No, there's no sharing or anything like that. But the point is, I can't give blood. You know, even though I don't have anything that I can pass on to anybody, but I have the antibodies that was there, you know. So I just be careful that people be like, oh, I'm not getting a blood transfusion, you know, because Timmy said on the podcast, so I just had to be careful.
Yeah. So, well, I didn't mean nothing by it.
Yeah.
I just meant like, but it has happened in the past. You do hear stories where people do get transfusions and they pick up some form of disease, but that's probably before these days.
We hope it's not like that no more, anyway.
But because there'll be people up my fucking door,
yeah. But even people that have HIV that might be listening to the podcast, like, nobody wants HIV, but it's not the death sentence it used to be.
No,
do you know, and people do survive and live fulfilled lives while on medication. Thankfully, you didn't get it. So, what happened after that?
So, like, you know, I got myself into the trouble with the crime and that at that time. Then around that time I started currying. And that was going good for me, like, in that. But the guards really, really, really had it out for me in the world. They were just torturing me, like, you know what I mean? They really were. My friend, no one could even hang with me or to torture anyone who was hanging out with me. They really wanted to stop me what I was doing, and, you know, so I remember the raid at my home place for drugs, like, and I remember the head of the DS coming up to me and saying, what's your address? And I says, no fixed abode, like, I'd always say that to him, you know, and he says, well, it's down as your home place, that's where you're living. He says, we're going to raid that for drugs. And I looked and I said, don't you go near that house? Like, I said, you know, like, they're, you know, good people and never involved in crime or anything, like, really good people, you know. And he just looked at me and says, I bet you'll piss you off, won't it? And next morning, went out and raided the place for drugs, like, you know. So you know, I was only one bit of it. Like, you know, they were just absolutely torturing me, and they arrested me one time, and I had a fair the other one arrest me, and I went and I cut my wrists in the cell. And
in the guard station.
In the guard station, yeah. They played me pocket. They didn't get it, like. Cut my wrist in three places, like, and when it had done, then I said, oh shit, what did I do? And actually, you know, I want to see the blood coming out and everything. I said, oh no, I don't want the next thing. I went up to press the buzzer, and there's no bloody, the buzzer was broken, like. So I just lay back then. Lucky enough, someone came to check me after a few minutes, you know.
Can I ask you about the time when you cut yourself? Like, what's going through your head? Are you depressed from drugs, or is just the lifestyle getting too much for you? Have you enough? Or?
I was taking a lot of cocaine at the time, and there was a lot of anger in me. Like, there was a lot of anger in me against the guards. Like, and you know, it was just
a release. Like,
yeah, my head was just all over the place. Like,
so yeah, there was a lot it's of drugs. It was it's a way away from feeling what's going on for you.
Yeah. Well, look, it was. I feel like it was done through anger, like, really was done through anger, like.
To say that, you know, people that self-harm like that, like, they're so much internal emotions that they can't handle, and internal pain that the cutting takes out your head and it focuses around that, you know what I mean? So it's like it takes for coping skills, you know?
Makes sense too, doesn't it?
Yeah, because when you cut your wrist, like, fucking hell, you're out of your head then, you're like, oh my God, I'm bleeding, you know? Mm.
There's a sense of relief from it as well, because when I was young, I would have self-harmed as well. But there was a sense of relief seeing yourself being cut and blood coming from it. There's a sense of, you know, it takes, as you said there, James, you were spot on, it takes you over your head, and now you're focused on this, and there's nearly a little bit of, will somebody notice and give me a bit of attention?
Yeah.
You know, that's because I wasn't getting very much attention at the time, but when they see that, it's negative attention, but it's still attention.
It's like physical pain is probably easier to handle than emotional pain, you know?
Okay.
It's like if you're in emotional pain, then you cut yourself and next you feel relief.
Yeah.
You feel relief from physical pain. It means obviously. But the guards, they arrived eventually.
Yeah, they did, yeah. And the ambulance drivers came in and took me out. And well, actually, on the way out, then the guard that actually said that to me, berating the home place and that, he was standing there. And the ambulance driver says, why'd you do that? And why'd you do that? And I says, because of him there. And I went for him, and I had to put the guard actually in the cell. Because I was going to, you know, but I know. So I got brought to the hospital, got stitches in my arm and that, and bandaged up. And then it was a few days after that, then I got arrested again and brought to court, and bandaged all around my arms and that. And they arrested me for break of bail conditions and sent me to Cloverhill Prison. And to me, to this day, I think the guards had some kind of connections with the governor over the prison, because they left me in a holding cell for 7 days, like, with no clothes on me, it's freezing cold, like. Pure torture.
Mm.
So I was in, I got out of the padded cell like for 7 days. I was in there for 7 days, got out of the padded cell after 7 days, and into the prison then. I was there for a total of 3 weeks, like, and I got out of the prison. And
did you know anybody in there?
No, it was remand prison, you know, like, they're not just
So for people that don't know fuck all about prisons, Cloverhill is where people can go when they're on remand for cases, or they can go there. Like, a lot of people from Cork prison would go, if they got denied bail in Cork, they go to Dublin to the High Court for bail and go to Cloverhill while they're waiting on the court. But you were denied bail, or you were brought in off bail?
Yeah, I was being brought in for break of bail, yeah.
And you were in there for 3 weeks?
3 weeks, yeah.
It's your first experience in prison?
First experience, yeah.
Tough one, isn't it?
Especially, it was a tough one. Like, you know, when I came out, I just turned my life around, like, in a positive way. Like,
what was it like? What did you do when you got out?
I got out. I went to a friend that had a business that was involved in furniture and that, and I went to him and asked him, could I get a partnership in his business? Well, could I do my own? Would he rent a bit of his shed to me, like, you know, so I could do my own stuff, like? And he said he would, and It was in my local village. The workshop was behind the guard barracks, like, right behind the guard barracks. And I was carrying up furniture every day and putting on the footpad for sale and that. And the guard just came up to me saying, fair play, you've turned your life around. I wouldn't drive or anything, like, you know what I mean? I caught myself on. I said, no way do I want a life at that prison stuff. Like, you know, it really woke me up. Like, So turned my life around, and it was enjoying, like, really enjoying life, like, for the first time ever. I mean, life, I was really, really enjoying life, you know. And Now, in regards to the machinery took and all that, like, it was all left back, like, so I didn't feel like there'd be much about that. So I was still waiting for that court case, like, so the machinery took, it was all left back. So that court case was still coming up. So I came up, I had that business going for maybe about 9 or 10 months, like, then I went to court, and the sergeant basically stood up in the stand and told lies, like, said to the judge, I don't know if anything about Jerry changed his life around or anything about him having a business, or really just sent me down, like, you know. So I got 2 years that day that I didn't expect, like, then yeah, I got 2 years. And
where did you go for the, where were you sentenced to?
Mount Joy.
Is that where people from Loud go?
Yeah, well, I was sentenced in Monaghan, so it was.
So you're sentenced to people from Monaghan, they go to Mount Joy, is that typical?
Yeah.
And what was it like in there? Cultural shock.
Brave shock again, yeah. It was a brave shock, like, you know.
Especially if you're after turning your life around.
Yeah.
And then to go into court and be given a prison sentence, and to be going in there then with a good space in your mind, and
into the negativity.
You're going in there then and you're caught up in fight or flight. You know, the adrenaline's pumping through your body because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you're walking down the landings and they're all just staring at you, you know. It's a tough environment to be put into, like.
It was tough. I think what annoyed me more was, you know, I knew that the guard, like, I knew it was him that just wanted to send me down, like, because when I got to 2 years and I was in the holding cell, in the barracks, like, he came down and he lifted the latch up, and I could see someone give me the finger, like, and I went up and I looked out, and there he looked through the latch, like, and there he was giving me the finger, like, you know what I mean? So more or less, I got you, like, you know. Yeah.
Did you know anybody in Mount Joy?
No, I didn't.
So, do you know when you went in there first, how did you integrate? Like,
well, funny enough, now when I got sentenced, there was two guys there that got sentenced same time as me, and they got 12 years, like, and we were in a holding cell in Mount Joy they were there for about 3 days, and they got moved out, like, but I got on well with them guys. They were from Limerick, and then I was in that cell, holding cell, for about, I think, about 6 days, because it was overcrowded at that time. Then I got sent into a four-man cell then. But there was a guy there, and he was probably in a prison all his life, but he used to leave a syringe and under my pillow at night, like, do you know what I mean? So what can I say, like, do you know what I mean? Yeah. At that time, you know, so.
Did you start using heroin inside though?
Not at that time, no, not at that time. But I did start heroin when I was in prison, yeah.
Okay. Was it in Mount Joy?
No, so I got moved to Port Leash, and I said I'm going to make the best of a bad situation. I got stuck into the gym and I was going to the gym 3 hours a day, and there was another guy I met, and me and him was training together, a big, big lump of a lad, you know, and then we got moved to an open prison, locked in a house. And one day I walked into his cell, and there he was smoking heroin, like, and I was like, Jesus, and I just walked back out. First time I've ever seen it, like. I seen needles in that before, but I never actually seen it on tinfoil. And then he came back up to my cell and he's, look, Jerry, it's not all that bad. And I was there, I don't know, it's not for me, like. And the same day I took two Valium tablets, so I was a bit relaxed to myself, you know.
Inhibitions were low.
Yeah. And I laid back and said to myself, look at the size of him, like, he's a big, strong lad. Maybe it's not that bad, I'll try it, like. So I went back down and I said, look, give me a blast of there. So I took a few lines of it and went back, and when I puked and back down and lay down in my bed, and I thought I'd close my eyes for an hour, but it was 12 hours, like. And I said, geez, this is some job for passing time, like.
I know.
And then my third time, like, I knew nothing about the sickness of heroin, like. I knew nothing about it, like. Farmer by, I suppose, you know, never knew anything about it, like. So the third time I took it, I says to a man, I says, geez, I don't feel well myself, you know, and he says, that's a sickness. I says, what? Sickness? What do you mean sickness, like? You know, and he says, you need to cure. So that's
when if you smoke heroin for a few days, for a period of time, and then you don't have it, you go into physical withdrawal. Like, anybody that takes any opiates for a period of time, people that are addicted to painkillers, like Norfin, any codeine based, if you take them for a period of time and then you don't have any, you'll be physically sick, and that's kind of the physical dependence, you know. So you experience that up there. It's not in locking house, it's an open prison, it's in Cavan.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any like urine tests or anything like that?
Oh, there was, yeah.
And did that ever, did we ever turn out of there for it, or we have divided, or?
No, I was thrown out of Loughlin House, but not for that reason.
Oh.
That's another story.
Well, I'm sure you might as well tell us.
So I'm here now, might as well tell you, right? So,
if you're comfortable.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's all in my book, so, it's all in my book, so I'm not, you know.
If you're comfortable, we'll talk about whatever you're comfortable about, you know, because your story is very important.
Yeah.
You know, it just talks about how it could happen to anybody.
Of course,
You don't have to be growing up in one of the worst parts of the country, worst towns or cities. It can happen to a lad who's brought up on the farm in the middle of the countryside, you know.
Of course,
and it's very, very important. So, as I said, whatever you're comfortable with.
Yeah. Well, look, that's why I'm here today. And, you know, it will make someone... If I had been listening to myself 20 years ago, maybe I might have made mistakes.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point.
You know, that's it, really, you know.
Yeah.
So I got my first weekend out of prison in Loughlin House.
How far from Loughlin House are you living?
It's been an hour and a half from my hometown.
Yeah.
And so I went out on the beer and I was drinking the same way as I thought I could drink before I went in, like. And I got a bottle of vodka and I downed it and stone drunk. And me and a friend of mine, we were acting deep with these aerosol cans. I was after spilling whiskey on my jeans and from my knee to my feet, like.
Mm.
And we were acting these aerosol cans, pinting at each other, messing, you know. And my jeans went on fire from the inside. And I had that much drinking, I didn't know the fucking legs was on fire. Like.
Mm.
Woke up the next morning with 4 degree burns.
Fucking hell.
On my leg, like. And cut a long story short, I had to go to the Burns unit at Dublin and was in there for 3 weeks.
It must have been serious.
Oh, very bad. Skin grafts and all, like, you know. Yeah.
You look, you didn't burn something else off.
Whatever
about the legs. The other thing was gone anyway, you might as well pack it up.
We'd have ended up with Noah Langer, you would have been fucked then. But you were in hospital for 3 weeks.
Yeah, now when I went in first, I knew heroin was good for pain, like.
Yeah.
And I rang a dude up and I says to him, I said, look, I'm in hospital here. What way? I don't want to inject it. I said, well, the way can I take it? He says, snort it like a lane of coke.
Mm.
So I got some left in and that. And I done exactly what he said to do. Like, I snorted like a lane of coke, probably with that size there. Do you know what I mean? Next thing, boom, I was out, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I write about in my book, and, like, as I say in my book, like, you know, there's no words to give it credit to what I felt like.
Mm.
And it wasn't from the taking of heroin. It was because I went to the other side, like.
Mm.
I died in the hospital bed.
I was just going to say, do you know, snorting heroin, it's a very, very dangerous way of taking the drug.
I know.
I know.
Figured that,
there's a few people from Knocknaheeny have died from it, that I know well.
Yeah.
And, even when I was snorting it myself, you could take it, like, heroin is a potent enough drug when you're in small amounts of it. And when you smoke it, obviously it takes time because you know, it may take it 15, 20 minutes to get through the bag. But when you snort it, you take the whole out of it and it doesn't hit you straight away. Like, I've injected too, so when you inject the drug, it hits you like that. Someone's going to the blood, you're gone.
Yeah.
But when you snort it, you don't feel nothing. And then it creeps up on you. And then before you know it, you're fucking cured. And so let's say if you, and this is my experience, but if you snorted a bit of gear, you might give it 5 or 10 minutes and then you might take another small bit, you know, and then before you know it, you're unconscious. You know?
And what the whole moral, what we're trying to say here is do not snort heroin. Like,
yeah.
Or if you take a full stop.
Don't take a full stop. If you're going to snort it, snort it with somebody next to
you. But you know where people do get confused around the heroin? And some films or series, whatever they might be watching at home, people are snorting heroin and they're looking at them getting a buzz off it or whatever. That is not the reality of it. You know,
just
heroin
will
kill you, like, immediately, you know.
It shuts down your respiratory system. So
especially if there's whatever mixes in it these days, like that fentanyl or whatever else. Like that can kill you, like that.
But the heroin tells the brain stops telling the lungs to move, basically, and your lungs just stop breathing, and it suppresses the respiratory system. So that's what happened to you.
Mm.
But lucky you were in the hospital when it happened.
Oh, yeah.
You think about like fellas that are doing in their bedroom. That's how fellas are found dead, you know what I mean? And the longer you're under, like, the brain damage happens then, you know? Mm. So if you're found, you could have, you know, damage, you know, that you can't undo from lack of oxygen to the brain. Mm. We know people like that, told you me.
Yeah.
But you were very lucky, Jerry.
Blessed, yeah.
What was it like when you came around?
It was...
What was it like under, or what's your memories of that whole time?
Look, I went to the other side, and all I could feel was just pure love and peace.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And I didn't want to come back here. You know, I thought the doctor that had the defibrillator shocked me. I thought he was like, you know, he's the devil. Like, you know, why are you doing that? Like, just leave me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that time, like I was there, like, Jesus, why did I get a second chance? You know, I'm someone that's in prison, drug addict, like, you know, what good am I to say it? You know, at that time I thought that, you know, but it was a plan for me, you know, and I'm still here.
Yeah. So did you go back to Loughlin House?
Went back to Loughlin House, and then the governor thought it was a Naira punishment beating us after getting, because I told him I fell asleep in front of a fire.
He wasn't believing that. Know,
I couldn't tell them I was out drinking, like, you know, so they didn't believe that. So I got sent to Castlereagh then, and I was in crutches.
County Roscommon.
Yeah.
Rough. What was it like over there?
Yeah.
Was that the roughest prison you were in?
Cloverhill and Castlereagh, look, I think Cloverhill probably would have been the worst, but Castlereagh now, it was probably because I was in crutches, I ended up getting bullying.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was, I had sleepless nights over it, like, you know what I mean?
Were you in a single cell or doubled up or what?
Single.
And were you were isolated over there?
Like, no, I was just, it was on the landing, like, single cell, yeah.
And, you know, like, when, do you know when you're in Castlereagh and you're being bullied, like, have you any friends over there? Do you know anybody over there? Or?
As I was saying there, was two Limerick guys that. So I became very good friends with them. Actually, you know, the word God sent through my sentence, like, you know, so I became good friends with them. So I had their number, like I took my phone with me from Loughlin House back to Castlereagh. So I had my phone with me, like.
Illegally.
Of course.
Yeah. That was probably inside in the bandage. We're giving out all the secrets, you know.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I called them guys up and I said to them, you know, like, I'm getting hassled here, like, you know. And they said, look, we'll sort something out because they're big connection, these guys, like, you know. But the guys was coming in just about 5 days passed and I couldn't sleep at night or anything. I was off the crutches this stage. Couldn't sleep at night, it was just pure anger, like, you know, with these three guys coming in all the time looking for me fags, like. And then one morning, so I just started getting myself back in shape again, exercising my leg and that, you know, so I was able to walk again, I was off the crutches, and then the ringleader came in his own one morning. But I was set to take the three of them out on my own, like, I had enough, like, at this stage, so I had it all planned out, like. And but he came in his own. And when he came in the zone, I banged the cell door over, like, and kind of choked him against the wall for a while. And he was shouting and roaring the prisoner, or the screw came up and opened the door, like, and he looked in and he knew what was going on, like, but he didn't say anything. I didn't get in any trouble about it or anything like that. But then the next day, this big guy came in with tattoos on him. I was like, oh shit, like, I'm bollocks now, you know. Well, next thing, it was actually the Limerick boys that sent the boy with the tattoos. To see if it was all right, and I told him to crack, and he sat with me and a cup of tea, and just we were having a cup of tea, and that next thing, the three boys was walking past that was bullying me, like, and they looked in, and next thing I said to your man, that was the guys, like, and he just stared, and this guy was a scary, he was in for life, like, you know, he had nothing to lose, like, he was a scary boy, like, so I'd say they were the boys shitting themselves after that, like, you know, but yeah, that was my experience.
That was the end of the bullying?
That was the end of the bullying.
Yeah, it just shows where you stand up to the bullies and...
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
But look, I was just an easy target. Like.
You know. That is... Your story is the reality of a lot of stories like that in the prison.
You know.
You You know, I've seen some stuff.
It's horrible, isn't it? And, especially when you have a disability like that, like, you know, how you're defenceless, you know what I mean? And in an environment like that, like, you will be preyed upon, like, especially when you're not in your hometown, you don't know anybody. Did you end up going back to Locking House, or did you get released from there?
I got released from there, yeah.
You had a rough old time of it all the same, didn't you? And you got a tour of Ireland as well.
For free, yeah. Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah, I got released from there, but, you know, I came out just lunatic altogether, like.
Did you?
Ah, yeah, so it, more connections.
You know, that's what happens. You would have, you were a drug addiction to heroin as well.
Yeah, yeah, you know? I came out with that as well, like, you know, and best contacts around Ireland for stuff, and yeah.
And what was life like when you got out? Did you go back to your hometown?
Yeah, yeah, I did. I went back to my hometown, yeah.
Were you back working, or did you go back into crime? Or?
I was a crime for a while, and then I started selling cowers then. And, yeah.
Not a form of crime? Ripping people off?
No, I didn't.
We all know the used cows, yes, man. The nicest people, like. But,
best, so
you went legit?
I went legit, yeah, yeah, I did, yeah.
So, to speed things up a little bit, how did you end up getting in? Like, I'm looking at some of the stuff. You've a diploma in body language, a diploma in addiction therapy, certified life coach, and then you have the businesses that we spoke about, including the pub landlord, which we haven't spoken about. How did you end up getting into the self-help piece? How did that come about?
From a very young age, from as 10, 11, I always had a dream when I'd be older that I'd be like a doctor or a psychiatrist or a counsellor or something like that. That's always was my dream, like, you know. And then I thought I went down the wrong road, but I actually didn't. I went down a road that I've experienced at all, and I came out the other end of it, you know. And I remember going on an event one time, and I just seen guys, you know, that I was running it, you know, like with... You know, guys, not like myself, but, you know, like business owners and that. And, you know, because I thought you'd need some kind of diploma to do all this kind of stuff, you know. And it just changed my life, what I learned at that event. It just totally changed my life, so it did. And then after that, then my sister passed away. She was only 22.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And I said to myself, you know, like... It's time for me to make a change, like, you know, and I set a goal when I was on that event to become a public speaker. And there was a guy that was at the event, heard my story, and he says, look, he says, I'd like you to do a talk for me on well-being and that. And so the goal I had set, I said, if I was ever asked to speak, I'd always say yes, you know. So I set that goal, was asked to speak, and went and I spoke at it and started me off with that, started me off getting into that. And yeah, it's
what was it like doing the first public speak?
Tough, isn't it?
It's my neck from here down just wouldn't stop shaking, like.
Yeah.
You know, just uncontrollably, just would not stop shaking, like.
And how are you doing today?
Yeah, look, I'll give you an example. So the way when I run my events, I was running one there in August, and there was a couple of people that was coming, that was in this game longer than me, they're in it 15, 20 years, like, coming to listen to me that and see what it's about. And there's a woman that works on my team with me, and she says, are you nervous, Jerry? And I looked at her and I says, do you know what? I says, I never was as confident doing something in my life as I was driving. You know what I mean? That's how confident I am in what I do now. I have the same confidence that I had when I was driving. In what I do now.
You know what I get since we've sat down here at the table? I get a real sense of authenticity. I've just been real about what you're about and who you are. And there's a real calmness around you as well. You know, it's just a really relaxed energy. You can probably feel it as well.
Well, yeah, pure relaxed. Yeah.
Well, I feel it from you guys too. Like, yeah. You know, it's...
On this podcast, you just have to be yourself.
Absolutely.
As simple as that. There's no like, nobody's talking about crime, like, I was this big fucking mad gangster. It's not that.
Yeah.
This is just what my life was like, you know what I mean? For good or for bad.
Yeah. And going back to the, even the public speaking side of it there, it is a difficult process for any human being, but I'm sure at some stage in your life and in my life, we would have thought that, nah, I could never do that. You know, but no, it just goes to show that any human being can do absolutely anything with their lives. They can become a public speaker. They can become a doctor. They can be, it's all about how much they want it, you know, and it's about, it's also about a massive part of it is about overcoming those fears. You know, you're going to feel a lot of fear. You're going to feel anxious. You're going to feel, you know, it's terrible, you know, and I remember me and James were on the Claiborne show there recently, and there was cameras there. There was Claire. There was an audience there. My heart literally was beating completely out of my chest, and my mouth started going dry, you know, and I started laughing. In the middle of the show, I started laughing to myself, saying to myself, what the fuck am I doing here? I looked around and said, what the fuck am I like? What am I doing here? And I'm sitting in a chair and bright lights and all this. And next, all of a sudden, she says, and you, Timmy, can you tell us? And I said, oh, next, these words were coming out of my mouth. I didn't even know what I was saying. You know, I forgot what the question was, you know. But the point being, I felt that feeling of real, really strong fear and anxiousness. Two of us we were speaking about it afterward. The two of us felt it, but the next time will be easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Public speaking is there's a skill in it, you know, and that part of the skill is trying to be composed and try to keep be calm. There's a buzz out of it too.
Here, man, when I done my first talk, drug never gave me that feeling.
Yeah.
Oh, buzzing. Yeah, absolutely buzzing, yeah.
And you do your own events today.
Yeah,
Do you want to tell us a little bit about them? What are they like? And are they weekend events or are they...
Look, they're three-day events. You know, I have had all walks of life come to them. You know, if you go on to my Facebook page there, you'll see testimony videos like from school teacher, just all walks of life. Like, do you know what I mean? And for me, I'd be watching testimony videos of the people sometimes, and I'd tear up, like, because that's my dream. Like, I'll give you an example of my next 3 day of what I'm doing is on the 3rd of February on my birthday. Like, that's how much I love doing them. Like,
that's nice.
It's just seeing the results in the people. Do you know what I mean? It's just seeing them. You know, like, I've seen people, like, you know, come in nervous and you know what I mean, suffer anxiety, and then just to see them after. You know, I just had a girl that there was at me one in August, and she was from England, and she was back there at the weekend, and she's just so calm. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Just so relaxed. And another guy was saying to me, I saved his life. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, to hear that stuff. Like, so I'm living my dream. Like,
I think is very important about your events as well is they're different to everything else. It's about forgiveness. You base them on forgiveness and letting go. You know, that's very important. We had a brief chat beforehand about forgiveness. And forgiveness is a word that can be used a lot, but there's a lot to forgiveness, because forgiveness is also, it's attached to resentment, people, you know. But to be able to really forgive somebody is like, it's a feeling. You know, it's not just a word, oh, I forgive you, but it's a feeling. So whenever you see a person that's connected to an experience with you, maybe a negative one, and it's to be able to feel love for them instead of complete resentment there. I don't like the word hatred because it should be a word. Hatred is a really strong word, but forgiveness. Can you tell us a little bit about the word forgiveness and what it means to you?
So I can tell you on my experience in forgiveness, you know, and the results, like, you know, so forgiveness is just one thing that I do at my events. Like, I go through a lot of stuff, like, you know, it's all stuff that I've put into practice in my life, stuff that I've changed my life, you know what I mean? It's all stuff that I've played my life first before I teach it to people. But, you know, one of the things I really get people to do at my events is finding their purpose in life. You know, because when you find your purpose, there's no stopping you, like.
Mm.
You know, I found my purpose, but everybody's purpose is different, like. Do you know what I mean? We all have a purpose here. So I show people, like, that. Like, my book's called You Can Do Anything. because you can, like. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? When you find your purpose, there's nothing will stop you. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, you know, sometimes, you know, we give our energy to what's not serving us, you know, to getting the next bag of coke or getting the next bag of heroin. Do you know what I mean? We're putting, we're guiding our energy towards that. That's what we would be thinking at the time. That's our purpose. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But when you actually find your purpose from your heart, do you know what I mean? All the cravings or all your energy that's going to get them bags, next thing you put it towards your dream, like. Mm. So you're putting your energy towards something else, your passion, like. You know, so I help people find that, and, you know, I just showed them how to do that. And, you know, it's just because, like, I had business before and I'd never say that I failed at them. I learned from them all, like. I learned where I went wrong with them, you know. And I showed people where I went wrong, and I showed them, like, I started this business just before lockdown, and the business still going, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the job I had before that, I really liked that job, you know what I mean? It was a handy job, I was getting paid well. And I didn't step back to that job. I stuck with this one. Do you know what I mean? Because sometimes we give up too easy.
Mm.
There's a story in Think and Grow Rich, 3 foot from goal. Do you ever read that?
Mm.
Look, I probably haven't the time to get into it now, but I'll tell you the short version of it. Yep. It's basically about a man that bought all this drilling equipment to mine for gold, right? Called long story. He got some gold and to pay for the equipment and that. And then he was drilling away again and he couldn't get any gold. So he gave up and he sold all the machinery to a local scrap man. And the scrap man got a specialist in to check. And they drilled down 3 foot and got all the gold, millions and millions worth of gold. Like, moral of the story is there, we give up too easy.
Mm,
you know, yeah. So that story stood with me a lot through, because it made me realize, you know, when at the pub and the car business, all that stuff, I give up too easy, you know, so I'll never give up in this business. Like.
Have you any advice for somebody that's watching and listening that's stuck in a dead end job that they're unhappy with, they haven't found their purpose? And maybe they're getting up on a Monday morning and they're thinking, fucking hell, is this as good as it gets for me? How do we find our purpose? Or what can we do to help?
Well, how I found my purpose was I went on an event, like, you know, and I broke my limiting beliefs, you know. Ask yourself, what is it you'd love to do in life, you know? And then start taking steps to work to make that happen, like. Do you know what I mean? Like, so when I went to school, I was laughed at if I put my hand up to answer a question, like, even by the school teacher. Do you know what I mean? But I always wanted to try and get something right, but I never could. Do you know what I mean? So what I'm saying is I was the worst student in school, like. So if I can do that, I couldn't read or write when I left school, like. And still have started my second book now, like. Do you know what I mean? And I can read now. Do you know what I mean? That's my, I found my purpose, you know, but we all have a purpose. We all have different things, like. Do you know what I mean?
You said something important there. You said about kind of losing the self-limiting beliefs, because, like, if you have experiences, like, we've all had bad experiences of school and you come out there thinking education is not for me, that is a self-limiting belief. But when you can push through that and try education, then you might realise, fucking hell, that belief I held for years was actually untrue.
Yeah.
And something I taught myself for years was actually holding me back all this time.
Breaking
boundaries and stuff.
And
getting to a limit. And what happens is when you do hit a certain stage in that, then the education, when you go to a certain level and you start believing that when your grades are consistently at 70 and 75 and 80%, a belief that, God, you know what, I actually can do it, and the confidence starts coming then with that, and self-belief, and you're changing that belief that's ingrained into you.
You know, start getting new beliefs then.
Yeah.
And then you start the challenge from my own experience. Start thinking, what other beliefs have I got that fucking, that I could never drive with the opposite to you? I was off the road for, when, you know, being in stolen cars when I was younger. So I thought I'd never drive, you know? Because you're like, when you're off the road and then you're in other robbed cars and you're off the band, the endorsements, you're thinking, fucking hell, they're never going to drive. But then in a year or two in recovery, the band is starting to tick down and say, fuck it, we'll learn. We'll do the theory test anyway. And then before you know it, you know, you're buying a car or, you know, university, marriage, you know, these things, like having your own gaff, you know. It's like fucking things that I thought that would never happen, but They do happen, but they'll only happen by challenging the perceptions we hold, you know, and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. Do you know if somebody wanted to go to your event, is the Facebook the best place to get you?
You'll get me on Facebook, yeah. You'll get me on Facebook.
Do you know, for the practicalities of the event, are they 3 days long, you said?
3 days long.
Yeah. Are they up in Monaghan, Cavan?
Our next one's in February in Westport.
Come to Galway.
Westport, yeah, Mayo. No,
oh,
Westport.
Mayo, sorry.
Yeah, Mayo.
It's very important classification. Yeah. No, we weren't up there.
Oh, yeah.
Were we supposed to go up there?
Westport, where's something about Westport is coming into my head there at the moment.
There's a great story to where I'm running dim events down Westport. I wrote about a guy called Austin in my book.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. Oh, you'll meet him someday. Lovely guy, like. But he's after building this retreat centre. Beautiful place down in Westport.
Yeah, I suppose that's the same guy, yeah.
Yeah.
My brother Tommy was telling me he was up there and he said it was something out of this world.
It's an amazing place, you know. So we were the first ones in the door. Like, I used to work for Austin years ago, like, and look, it's an amazing place, you know. So that's where it is in February.
If people are interested, what can they expect? Is it like meditations, talks, get-togethers?
Look at this one here now. At the moment, we get the people, you know, if they can, to go down on the Thursday evening. Do you know what I mean? Land down the Thursday evening, chill out and relax. Then the event starts on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You know, so like if you have a look at some of the testimonies, you'll see what some people has got out of it. Like, you know, but you'll just, you were talking about forgiveness there, you know, that's one part of it, you know, but it's like a program I have designed. Do you know what I mean? That'll go through each day. Do you know what I mean? You'll just find yourself just more at peace. You'll also find, you'll find your true potential. Like, that's my goal to bring to the people, to like, get them to find that in themselves. Like, because they hear me talk and they see that I can do it. Like, but I show them exactly how I done it and how they have to do it. And it also comes with, which is very powerful, coaching sessions after. Like, you know, it's really, the coaching sessions is really like very important after, you know, because it keeps you up there.
Excellent. And we'll put all the links into the description of the video and the podcast.
And
your link book. To the book.
Yeah.
Congratulations on the book. Best of luck with the second book.
And your second book.
Thanks to me.
The journey continues.
Absolutely.
I know you're on the Twin Alleys podcast, so it's all downhill from here, Jerry.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? We're after asking you a lot of questions there now, but is there anything that's in the back of your mind that you'd like to talk about?
No, look, man, you know, I'm delighted to be here. And it was actually, I think it was Stevie McGowan was telling me with you guys.
Yeah.
So I came home that day and I put this on YouTube and I seen what you're doing. I swear to God, I just got a tear down my eye.
Yeah.
Because this here is just so needed. Like, do you know what I mean? So what you're doing, guys, is amazing. You know what I mean?
Thank you very much, Julie. You know,
brilliant. No, thanks a million. And people are going to watch this and they're going to be able to relate to you, and we'll spread the message and we'll keep what we have by giving it away, as an old saying in recovery, and that's kind of what we're all doing here. So congratulations on everything you've done so far, and best of luck with everything you will do, and safe journey home.
Thanks James, thanks
very much for coming along. It was a pleasure meeting you again and chatting to you.
Likewise.
You know, and I mean that.
We see everybody next week. See you later, though.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.